Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're reading from the continuing from the fourth chapter of the sixth canto entitled Hungsa Guhya Prayers, text number 48. Vayananta gune nante gunato guna vigraha yadasit tata evadyak. Swayambhuk samabuddhajaha Vayananta gune nante gunato guna vigraha yadasi tata evadya Swayambhuk samabuddhajaha Vayananta gune nante gunato guna vigraha yadasit tata evadyak swayambhuk samabuddhajaha. Marchis. Mahi, in me, Ananta Gune, possessing unlimited potency, Anante, unlimited, Gunataha, from my potency known as Maya, Gunavigraha, the universe, which is the result of the modes of nature, Yada, when Asit, it came into existence. Tataha, therein. Eva, indeed. Adyah, the first living being. Swayambhuhu, Lord Brahma. Samabhut, was born. Ajaha, although not from a material mother. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. I am the reservoir of unlimited potency, and therefore I am known as unlimited or all-pervading. From my material energy, the cosmic manifestation appeared within me. And in this universal manifestation appeared the chief being, Lord Brahma, who is your source and is not born of a material mother. Purport. This is a description of the history of the universal creation. The first cause is the Lord Himself, the Supreme Person. From Him, Brahma is created, and Brahma takes charge of the affairs of the universe. The universal affairs of the material creation depend upon the material energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is therefore the cause of the material creation. The entire cosmic manifestation is described herein as Guna Vigraha, the form of the Lord's qualities. From the cosmic universal form, the first creation is Lord Brahma, who is the cause of all living entities. In this regard, Srila Madhvacharya describes the unlimited attributes of the Lord. Pratyekasho gunanam tu nesimatvam udiryate tadanantyam tu gunatas te chanantahi sankhyaya atonanta guno vishnor gunatonanta evacha. The Lord has innumerable potencies, all of which are unlimited. Therefore, the Lord Himself and all His qualities, forms, pastimes, and paraphernalia are also unlimited. Because Lord Vishnu has unlimited attributes, He is known as Ananta. Om Ajnanata Marandasya Ganandana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitang Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasai Bhutale Srimate Prahladananda Swami Tone. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasai Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tone. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Ade Sitarine. So this whole section here in the Hungsa Guyu prayers is rather nice. Lord Vishnu is really emphasizing how He is the source of everything and how everything is acting under personal direction. So in this particular verse, He's explaining how this universe was created from Him. In previous verses, it was explained how the demigods are His direct representatives and in charge of different aspects of the maintenance of this material world. And then also, it's been described previously, talking about manifestations of the form of different qualities of Krishna, but how they have how they're manifested here in this material world. And this is a really important point to understand, how everything that's happening is happening under personal guidance, personal direction. Nothing is being left up to chance. Nothing is just happening haphazardly, you know, by accident. I saw recently there was even this 12-year-old prodigy. He's like this genius who, you know, he has a little bit of a social dysfunction. He has what's called Asperger syndrome, which is a mild form of autism. And so it limits his ability to socially interact with other people, but at the same time, this kid is a brilliant genius. When he was 8 years old, he was already going to college. And now he's 12 years old and he's working on postdoctoral research in mathematics. And it's just really incredible. He's already proved via mathematics the impossibility of the Big Bang Theory. You know, this is a 12-year-old. And this is rather significant because the Big Bang Theory is one of the hallmark theories of all these impersonalistic academicians. You know, nowadays, especially in Western society, it's extremely impersonal. Everything about Western society is impersonal. Whether it be the internet, you know, our educational system, even the way that we interact with our peers, with other people within society, television, radio, advertisements, billboards, it's all impersonal. It's all impersonal ways of manipulating other people. I'll get into that a little bit more later. So in the purport here, Prabhupada references Prahasya Shaktir Vivaraya Shuyute. And that particular verse is elaborated upon very nicely in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the Madhya Lila, in one chapter that we read from every year, 13th chapter, text 65. Chapter is entitled The Ecstatic Dancing of the Lord at Rath Yatra. And this particular verse is rather nice. It's describing how Lord Chaitanya is in such an ecstatic mood that he wants to be simultaneously present in all the kirtan parties at the same time. And so one of his energies takes care of this for him, knowing the desire of the Lord. So his Lila Shakti expands himself into all the different kirtan parties. Translation of this text is, indeed, the personality of Godhead forgot himself in the course of his transcendental pastimes, but his internal potency, Lila Shakti, knowing the intention of the Lord, made all arrangements. So this is also very instructive as to the nature of this material world. Krishna, he's the supreme enjoyer. He doesn't need to be bothered by the mundane arrangements of our perverted and improper desires here in this material world. So rather, his external potency, his Maya Shakti, personally takes care of these arrangements. In the purport, it says, it is stated in the Upanishads, Prahasya Shaktir Vivadaya Shuyate Shabhavaki Gyana Balakriyacha. The Supreme Lord has multipotencies which act so perfectly that all consciousness, strength, and activities are being directed solely by His will. Shvetashvatara Upanishad 6.8. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exhibited His mystic power in presenting Himself simultaneously in each and every Sankirtan group. Most people thought that He was one, but some saw that He was many. The internal devotees could understand that the Lord, although one, was exhibiting Himself as many in the different Sankirtan groups. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu danced, He forgot Himself and was simply absorbed in ecstatic bliss. But His internal potency arranged everything perfectly. This is the difference between the internal and external potency. In the material world, the external potency, material energy, can act only after one endeavors at great length. But when the Supreme Lord desires, everything is performed automatically by the internal potency. By His will, things happen so nicely and perfectly that they appear to be carried out automatically. Sometimes the activities of the internal potency are exhibited in the material world. In fact, all the activities of the material nature are actually performed by the inconceivable energies of the Lord. But so-called scientists and students of material nature are unable to understand ultimately how things are happening. They evasively conclude that everything is being done by nature, but they do not know that behind nature is this potent Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita 9.10. Vyadikshena prakritis suyate sacharacharam hetunanena kaunteya jagadviparivartate. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So this is really the nature of things, how things are happening. Not only here in the material world, but also in the spiritual world. Everything is under the direction of some personality. Someone is in charge of everything. So, here in this material world, the different conditioned souls, they don't like the idea of authority or the idea of personalism, because from a long history of impious activities and a long history of experiencing negative experiences from other people, people have become disgusted with personal relationships. And we can see that practically in the breakdown of the family within the West. You know, you look in India, and the family unit is still extraordinarily strong. You know, to where you have the whole extended family living practically in the same room with each other. And everyone feeling, you know, very cozy. Very nice. Oh, you know, my mother, my grandmother, my children, my grandchildren, all here in the same room. Very nice. But here in the West, people get freaked out by that. Oh my God, you know, what's my, you know. It's just such a foreign concept. You know, so whether it's the children who are wanting to leave the family as soon as possible, or the parents who are kicking the kids out as soon as possible. One way or another, the family unit is just disintegrating. And even what to speak of the kids, even between husband and wife, they can't stand each other. So that's why the divorce rate is just so astronomically high in these Western countries. Because it's all impersonal. They don't care actually about the personal nature of the other person. Rather, they're just seeing some machine made of material energy meant for their sense gratification. It's a robot society. They're just seeing these robotic dolls meant to please them at the push of a button. Like, for instance, in Japan, robotics is huge over there. Everyone's into robots. Having their robot servants and having their robotic aides. Like, for instance, in Japan, none of the younger generation want to do the same things that the older generation did. So they're finding it extremely difficult to maintain the agriculture in Japan. Because none of the youth want to do it. No one wants to work in the field, pick vegetables, water the vegetables. Nobody's interested. So instead what they're doing is they're inventing different robots, different machines, to either pick the vegetables for them, or to strap on your body so that all these old people, when their bodies are so broken that they can't even bend over to pick a strawberry, then they just sit in this machine And then they can, with the machine, manipulate the machine to make it pick the strawberries for them. This is very impersonal society. This is the nature of the internet age also. It's just further enhanced this impersonalism. To where everything is 3 degrees removed from you at least. I've heard one person describe the internet age as postmodernistic voyeurism. You know, everyone wants to know everything about everyone else. Except they don't want to know anything about your personality. Anytime it comes down to actually getting to know someone, people get freaked out. Like so many internet romances have gone on. People meet over Facebook or, you know, on some social network or over email or whatever, and they get romantically involved, and then as soon as they meet in person, they may be married for a week, but then they immediately divorce. Because having this personal relationship is too much. It's too demanding. Even way back in the 70s or 80s, I forget exactly when the test was done, but it was this psychological test where there were two rooms. There was one person in one room, another person in another room. And the one person in one room was told that whenever they got a signal, to scream out in pain. And depending on the strength of the signal, to, you know, cry out in greater degrees of pain and agony. And the other person in the other room, they were told that there's someone in the other room and they're hooked up with electrodes. And when you turn this knob and push this button, it'll electrocute them. And you have to push this button whenever we tell you to. And so it was a psychological test to see how far people would go just when it involves pushing a button. And they had a microphone there so that they could hear the fake screams of agony. And so the director would tell the person, okay, turn the knob up higher and now push the button. So they push the button, they hear, ah! Okay, turn it up to the next notch. So they turn it up and they push the button and they hear even more terrible screams. And the people, they would twist that knob all the way to the maximum and they would just keep pushing that button time and time and time again. Even hearing these screams of the people that they think are suffering in the next room. This is the nature of impersonalism. It's really dehumanizing. It's really terrible for the heart. There's no compassion with impersonalism. There's no caring about anyone else or anything else. That's also the nature of many of the different modern religions. Out on Sankirtan, I've met so many people who claim to be religious, but then they describe what it is they believe in, and it's complete impersonalism. You know, or I meet people that say, well, I'm Christian, but I'm an atheist. And I'm like, you know, what's that? An atheistic Christian? Oh, I believe in Jesus, but, you know, I don't believe in God. You know, or even in Judaism, Bhrigu Padipuru was telling me that so many of the people who follow Judaism, they follow the ritual, but they don't believe that some God actually exists. Or even you ask different people, different traditions, can you describe God for me? And they have no answer. You know, the Muslims, oh, well, God has no form. They just outright say God has no form. Or the Christians, well, you know, he's like some old guy with this big beard and kind of, you know, some white space for his face. You know, and then you present Krishna consciousness and it freaks them out. It overwhelms them. Because from the beginning to the end, it's personal. They come here, they see the deities, they see the personal form of the Lord. And they get freaked out. Oh my God, so much detail. Because when there's so much detail, so much personal detail, they're put on the spot. It requires them to come up to some sort of standard of excellence. Some sort of expectation for personal behavior. When everything's impersonal, then it's left loose. You know, there's some leeway, there's some slack where you can get away with things. Just like slaughterhouses. If people were actually forced to slaughter their own flesh to eat, you know, like for instance, sometimes I describe to meat eaters that what they're eating is actually muscle. So this thing they call meat, this is muscle. Oh no, it's not muscle, it's meat. Like, well, what do you think meat is? Meat's the stuff that connects the ligaments to other ligaments to make the bones move. It's called muscle. No, it's not muscle, it's just meat, you know, it comes in the store. This is impersonalism. They don't see where this meat is actually coming from, that this meat comes from a person. That by eating meat, you're killing another person. They refuse to acknowledge it. Why? Because it holds them liable. It holds them responsible. You know, same thing like in Christianity with the Council of Nicaea. This is really the turning point when Christianity became extremely impersonal because it separated Christ from the people. One small change of words had such a profound impact. Before, it was said that Christ was created. The Council of Nicaea established that Christ was begotten. It sounds like a small difference, insignificant, but it's a very big difference. Because if Christ was created, then that means he's a jiva, like you and me. And this is how we take Christ. As a jiva soul, who is very spiritually advanced, and we accept him as a spiritual master. That's how Prabhupada explained it. But Christians say, no, Christ wasn't jiva. Christ was not created. He was begotten. Begotten means that he's directly God himself. And therefore, because he's God himself, he puts him out of our reach. So therefore, they can disregard all the things that Christ said. They can disregard how Christ said, follow in my footsteps. You know, this is the path to tread, and this is how to approach God. So do as I'm doing, follow in my footsteps, and you too can reach the same goal. But by saying that Christ was begotten, it puts this goal out of reach for people. And so consequently, people are justified now in doing whatever despicable activity they want to do. Because, well, you know, I'm just some fallen soul and, you know, how can I actually do anything because I'm imperfect and I was born with sin. Therefore, let me just take a bloodbath in Christ's blood and it'll blind God to all my sinful activities. This is the philosophy. But this is abominable. This is impersonalism. Even in this Krishna consciousness movement, people tried to do that with Prabhupada. Even when Prabhupada was on the planet. They tried to say, oh, Prabhupada's God. And Prabhupada heard about this and immediately squashed it. You know, and then one particular group of people, they want to kind of continue this impersonalistic attitude of saying, well, only Prabhupada is guru. This is impersonalism also. It's not wanting to accept a personal spiritual master. Not wanting to accept responsibility for your activities. You say, oh, well, you know, it's just, you know, Prabhupada's the only guru. You know, then you can do anything you want because there's nobody there to tell you, to chastise you when you do something that's improper. To say, no, you shouldn't be doing that. Rather, because there's no one there to tell you that, then you say, oh, well, you know, it's okay. You know, Prabhupada said this and Prabhupada said that. And you can say Prabhupada says until, you know, you're blue in the face. Even when Prabhupada is here, Prabhupada said, people who say Prabhupada said this, I didn't actually say that. So that's why Prabhupada was preaching so heavily about impersonalism, because it's so pervasive within society. Even within our own society, it's pervasive. So we really have to take these instructions seriously and really fully understand the implications of personalism and impersonalism. And we have to become personalists. So it's just about 8:15. I'll end there if there's any comments or questions. Mm-hmm. Well, this is specifically talking about Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma was born from a lotus flower that sprouted from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So that's one aspect of Krishna, is that he's absolute. Absolute means that everything is equal to everything else of him. So he can see with his fingers. He can taste with his ears. He can speak with his eyes. He can do anything with anything related to him. So he doesn't need some counterpart to be able to produce progeny. He can produce anything he wants of his own self. That's why it's described that Lord Brahma is not born from a mother, a material mother. He was born from the lotus flower that sprouted from Garbhodakshaya Vishnu's navel. Is that okay? Jai. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.